Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talk to Raphael Baer and George Eaton about labour in the middle class. Philip Maughan talks to Ryan Gilby about the controversial nature of The Wolf of Wall Street. And Ian Steadman and I discuss the drugs used to administer the death penalty in America. I'm joined by George Eaton, editor of The Staggers, and our political editor, Raphael Baer, to talk about the week in politics. Raph, we're going to start off talking about Labour's election strategy, because you interviewed Douglas Alexander, who, as well as being Shadow Foreign Secretary, is also in charge of Labour's election planning. Where are they on that?
That's a very good question. Douglas Alexander got the job in the reshuffle at the end of last year. There had been a degree of anxiety on the Labour side that they didn't really have anyone who was in charge of giving them the campaign that would enable them to win. The key message that I took from that conversation with Douglas was that the missing thing they feel that they really need to fill a gap is having some forward-looking offer about how Labour would deliver prosperity for the country, given that they have this criticism of George Osborne's austerity plans. They have this sort of complaint, essentially, about the cost of living. And what they recognise is that although they can get a bit of traction on the austerity thing, although, frankly, we all know they've sort of lost that argument quite badly in terms of people thinking Labour spending all the money was kind of the problem, they definitely feel they've won and are winning the argument on the cost of living, that people recognise that actually Ed Miliband is onto something when he says that even when the economy grows, it doesn't seem to turn up in people's pockets and the Conservatives are the party of the rich. Those are two important parts of the economic argument. The third very important part, and we pretty much accept that the election will be fought around the economy, is who actually has the best story to tell about how Britain is going to make its way in the future so that everyone feels the benefit. And they don't think the Tories have actually nailed that at all. They think the Tories are sort of facing backwards, trying to refight the last election. They accept that Labour hasn't really said anything about that yet, and so now the point is that's where they want the message to go.
And this makes quite an interesting counterpoint with what you wrote in your column, which is a lot about the Tories' election strategy. Specifically, this phrase we've heard a lot from Linton Crosby, it's this idea of scraping the barnacles off the boat, which actually some Tory MPs think has translated into a kind of monomaniacal focus on only bread and butter issues that risk them looking nasty.
Yeah, the criticism I'm starting to pick up of the Crosby approach is that it's all about priming the issues where people already think the Tories are good. So, which is that point about budget discipline, immigration, crime, toughness on all the things that we think Conservatives like to claim to be tough on. And what you do is you choose the issues that, first of all, are salient, people care about, which is immigration, the economy, crime, that sort of thing. You zero in on the ones where people think the Tories are strong and you ramp them up as hard as you can. So essentially you make the election about the things that people are going to go, this is what I care about, and lo and behold, the Tories are good on it. Ergo, vote Tory. And what the sort of moderate liberal Conservatives are saying is that it simply doesn't understand that actually the hurdle, the thing that stopped the Tories winning a majority in every single election of the 21st century, hasn't been that people really want them to be tough on immigration. It's that people don't trust them on a whole bunch of other things. That there's a sort of cultural barrier, there's sort of antibodies in the body politic for a lot of people against voting Tory.
This is like the idea of the NHS.
Yeah, so they don't trust the Tories with the NHS. They think the Tories are always going to favour their rich friends. And actually, the Crosby strategy simply doesn't doesn't have a mechanism for addressing that, sort of counteracting that inoculation that people have against voting Tory.
And George, immigration is an interesting issue because there's been quite a lot of apologies about not having the transitional controls when Poland, the labour market was opened up to them. Chukwuma Mouna last week on Question Time started trying to rewrite the Treaty of Rome, saying it was about movement of workers, not movement of persons. Where are Labour at the moment on immigration?
So Labour on immigration have moved significantly. I mean, actually, this is where arguably Miliband's moved Labour to the right. And every other issue, he's pretty much moved it to the left. But Blair, Mandelson, even Brown to an extent, the figureheads of New Labour, took a very liberal view of immigration, that it was part of a modern, globalised, open economy. Miliband actually argues that you need to regulate the free movement to labour as well as regulating markets to ensure that they work for the low paid in particular. And they say, yes, you can listen to economists like Jonathan Portes, who will tell you, and this is true, that immigrants are of net benefit to the economy, that they contribute more in taxes than they receive in benefits and services, but voters don't live their lives in the aggregate. And so in particular sectors like construction, like agriculture, there is evidence that immigration is having a downward pressure on wages.
That's a tricky point, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, Nigel Farage said even if immigrants were good for the economy, he still didn't want them. I can't imagine a Labour politician feeling able to say anything close to that. But that does seem to be, I mean, that's where the evidence now is, you know, that actually, I take your point about the aggregate. But so where does that leave Labour in terms of why they're opposed to immigration?
Well, they're trying to frame it as an economic issue and to say we want less low-skilled immigration and we want to ensure certainly that all employers pay the minimum wage. We'd like more to pay the living wage. And also every time that an employer hires a migrant worker, we're going to ask them to create an apprenticeship. So I think this is actually a position that Labour can go into the election with that will, I think they recognise that they're not going to outbid the Tories on immigration, they're not going to ever win on that issue, but they're going to try and neutralise it. And one Labour election strategist said to me recently that in some ways they're in a better position than the Tories because they haven't promised so much on immigration. So the Tories had this target,
the cap of 100,000, which everyone says they like in polling, and then everyone says they don't think that David Cameron will be able to achieve.
Yes, and they're not going to be able to achieve it. So but actually, because voters think Labour's in such a terrible position on immigration to begin with, any sign of improvement is a gain for them.
Yeah, I think that's quite an optimistic analysis of where Labour are on this. I mean, the problem they have, and it's very interesting, Chukwuma did say on Question Time that you know, free need to sort of re-examine the role of the free movement has within existing EU rules. Very senior Labour people over the weekend hosed that down, poured buckets of cold water on it, said it may have sounded like Chukwuma moved our position. He didn't. So they basically put him right back in his box. And the problem that they have essentially is that for a long time, you know, you've been aware that people don't like mass immigration, as they see it. There's another separate issue, which has been the public, British public being very Eurosceptic. Now, obviously, those issues are entirely connected in this question of free movement, and that's why it became that there was a sort of a flurry of panic around the idea of a sort of tsunami of Romanians and Bulgarians crossing the border on the 1st of January, which they didn't. But when you've got one of the big landmark political events of this year being May's European elections, the idea that really for the first time you properly get mass prop integration of the Europe question and the mass immigration question, obviously that's good for UKIP, it puts the Tories on the spot, but it's still terrible for Labour if that becomes embedded in everyone's minds, because then they start thinking, well, whenever you ask a question about what's Labour's position on immigration, you also ask a question about what's Labour's position on Europe, and if Labour have difficulty having a position on immigration, they're in even worse shape having a position on Europe.
And it becomes hard to talk about being able to say people don't care about Europe, because you're then acknowledging that Europe is actually a proxy for other things.
Exactly.
Whereas I feel the argument has been very successfully made that people really don't care that much about an EU referendum, except as a proxy for we're being ruled for by someone else and we don't have control over
ourselves. And if the old sovereignty argument, which you could easily say is something Bill Cash can kind of swivel his eyes over as much as he likes, no one really cares, the counter argument that gets stronger and stronger is, well, no, actually what we're talking about here is immigration.
And just quickly to finish, Ed Miliband wrote for The Telegraph, kind of moving out of his comfort zone a bit there, about defending the middle class. Now, there is a large looming question here about, I think you wrote about this, about what Telegraph readers consider the middle class to be when the median wage is £26,000 a year. What was the point of that pitch, George?
So I think there were 2 points. So this is Miliband returning to territories he's explored before. So the first piece he wrote in the Sunday Telegraph was on, after he was elected leader, was on the squeeze of middle. Now he's talking explicitly about the middle class. And I think, firstly, that's because a lot of the policies they announced around the conference, abolition of the bedroom tax, cracking down on exploitative zero-hour contracts, strengthening the minimum wage, were aimed at the low-paid, what we'd consider Labour's working-class core votes. So I think they feel that they need to broaden their offer to attract middle-income voters. But it's also because if you look at what's happened since the recession, it's that group that has experienced the largest fall in living standards. So they're better off than the low-paid.
Sorry, I should say that's not an ambulance coming to take George away or anything like that. We are broadcasting to you live from essentially a building site here. Sorry, George, carry on.
They have fallen the most. And so for that, they feel they have been particularly let down by the government, have been failed by the performance of the economy. And Miliband is trying to frame this as almost everyone is worse off except the 1%, except the very rich. And it's that group that he's going to say the Tories can't stand up to, only I can stand up to the strong. So it really is sort of a slightly different way of framing the 99% against the
1%. And also, I'm fairly confident what they will try to do, having sort of set out that pitch to the middle class, as they see it, is connect that to what we were saying at the beginning about a forward-looking offer for prosperity. They are going to try and raid the sort of Barack Obama campaign line about how the way you build an economy is from the middle out. You basically, your middle class is your engine of economic growth and progress. And if you've got these people who have suffered the most, you have to nurture them and look after them, because that's how you get sustainable growth in the future. And they can't use the line growing from the middle out, because Barack Obama got there first. What they are now thinking is, what is our equivalent line that says the same thing in different words that makes sense to people?
I have to say, one thing I'm feeling enormously grateful for, I'm reading Double Down, which is the account of the 2012 election race, and it talks specifically about that line about Barack Obama trying to appeal to the middle class, and the terrible state and the fact that, you know, that could have been lost in the election, in the sense of that lost him all the donors from Wall Street, all the bundlers that had previously paid millions and millions for the campaign were completely turned off by that. And there was one, I'm going to end with a final note of optimism, that at least that isn't a problem in British politics. Is it?
I think
it's not to the same extent, is it? I guess there's people like Lord Ashcroft in the past have put a lot of money into political parties, but
yeah, when the Tories have rich donors and Labour is bankrolled substantially by trade unions, and that is the structural balance of power in funding politics in this country, and everyone talks about changing it and nothing happens.
Which is going to be
sorry, you had optimism there.
No, I know, I crushed it again.
Yeah. We can cut this last bit from the podcast and end on your note of optimism. You don't even need to say what it is, just say you're feeling really optimistic.
I'm just feeling really optimistic, and on that note, thank you, George, and thank you, Raf.
So, Ryan, you've reviewed The Wolf of Wall Street in this week's magazine, and you describe it as a bestial, carnivalesque performance. What are some of the issues that are coming out of this film?
Well, it's the true story of Jordan Belfort, who was a stockbroker in the 80s and 90s, and he ran a boiler room business, and he was sent to prison for fraud. And, you know, the film kind of delves right into his life and his kind of hedonism, and you know, in the same way that, I mean, it's by Martin Scorsese, and in the same way that Scorsese got kind of right under the skin of the gangsters in Goodfellas, and you know, under the skin of Travis Bickle, the psychopath in Taxi Driver, you know, we're completely immersed in the stockbroker's world. So you know, it can be quite kind of alarming and disorientating to find yourself not exactly cheering them along, but just, you know, they're enjoyable escapades, a lot of the things that we see the stockbrokers getting up to in the film. And then, you know, hopefully if the viewer has any sort of presence of mind, you'll pull back at a certain point and realise that that it's not so amusing.
And the question really is to what degree Scorsese is indulging in the behaviour that's seen on screen, and to what degree he's condemning it. This has provoked a reasonable amount of controversy online, and even from, you know, I haven't seen the film yet, but I've seen the trailers, and it brings up all of those kinds of feelings about bankers, which have been in the air, and people who work in finance, which have been in the air since the financial crisis, really, which is to what degree Do we condemn this behaviour, and to what degree do we admire it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that I certainly wouldn't look to a film to give me that kind of point. And I'm glad in a way that Scorsese doesn't. Although I think that there is a kind of problematic fondness for the characters in the film, and the fact that the film gets so much of its energy, and it's just really one kind of energy. It's just real manic sort of momentum. It gets all that from their behaviour. So, in a way, although it doesn't endorse their behaviour, it's like without it, the film, you know, kind of wouldn't exist. That's what the film is. It's this kind of, for want of a better term, kind of roller coaster ride through, through the terrible things that the characters got up to. But I don't want Scorsese to kind of come out and say this is terrible, because hopefully, as I say, if we've got any presence of mind, we'll know already that it's terrible. But I think he's conflicted. I mean, it's actually quite bold to do, to make a 3-hour film about people who've made all of our lives noticeably worse. Our day-to-day lives are worse. We've got less money, we've got less
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Contentment because of people like this. I mean, in a way, I think it's more even riskier than when he made films like Goodfellas and Casinos, where we're watching violent kind of psychopaths whose actions haven't actually impacted directly on our lives in the way the bankers have.
Yeah. Do you think having Leonardo DiCaprio as the leading man may have something to do with this? So, he's clearly become something of a muse, or at least he's becoming a late face Scorsese sort of this is now his fifth film with Scorsese. Do you think, is it possible for him to play a dislikable character?
Oh, he does it so brilliantly. I think that's the key to it. I haven't really been that impressed by the work that he's done with Scorsese before, the four performances he's given for him before, but you just couldn't imagine anyone being any better, or any better cast in this role, or any he uses his charm so brilliantly to put us in that bind where we're enjoying being in his company, and yet he's doing really horrific things. It's just a brilliant performance. I don't think it's a brilliant film, but it's a brilliant performance.
More so than Gatsby, because of course the sort of smug luxuriating presence is there again, but this time and that time, I suppose, in both instances it falls apart quite readily.
They're similar. It's interesting that he did those both in the space for you. I mean, there's obvious overlaps between the part, but he gets to really have fun here, and he gets to be there's just some amazing kind of comic episodes where he gets to really let loose. There's one where he's a scene that's already becoming quite notorious, where he's under the influence of Quaaludes and loses all his kind of body coordination and power of speech and things like that. And it's just a brilliant piece of slapstick. I mean, it's just superbly controlled by Scorsese, by DiCaprio, and really nicely shot by Scorsese. He just holds this shot of DiCaprio kind of struggling to get to his car and then kind of hanging out of his car, and it's a really amazing scene.
So what if it's not if you're able to kind of go with the performance and so on, like where does your problem isn't per se the notion of indulging in the behavior that we already know is it's a known thing that's going to cause all kinds of problems. Where is your problem?
Yeah, I think the big problem is that Scorsese just isn't interested in anybody else in the film.
Yeah.
Just to take for a second the other stockbrokers, I mean, there aren't really any characters here. Everybody's got their own kind of quirk. Like Jonah Hill is DiCaprio, plays DiCaprio's kind of right-hand man, his best friend. And, he has these various quirks, like weird teeth, and he married his cousin and things like that. And everybody's, there's another guy who has a really obvious toupee. And then they're not characters. They don't have levels and layers in the way that that DiCaprio's character does. So that's kind of the main problem that I have with the film, in that just nothing else apart from Jordan Belfort is interesting to Scorsese and to the film, and everybody else is just a little sketch. But where that really becomes a problem is with the character of Naomi, who's Jordan's second wife. Just simply because we only see her the way that Jordan sees her. So she becomes this kind of, yeah, as you say, like a shrew and a nag. And in the worst scene, I think, in the film, she withdraws. When she finds out that Jordan has been unfaithful, she withdraws all kind of sexual attention from him, but takes the kind of parading around the house, sort of with her underwear and things like that. Mm. And you think, well, this is great because she's got here's someone who's actually challenging him and standing up to him and saying, no, you can't have things your own way. And then the scene takes a really nasty kind of misogynistic twist. I won't go into exactly what happens, but suffice to say that all her kind of triumph and victory is taken away from her, and she's humiliated for the sake of some cheap laughs for the audience, really. And Jordan is kind of restored back on top to his place of power. So it just seems really kind of blinkered. There are lots of ways you could have presented her, kind of more as a more forceful character in the film. Just give her a few more scenes. I mean, Margot Robbie, who plays her, is a really good sort of persuasive, powerful actress, but yeah, the character is just completely squandered.
Final question. Do you think this is Oscars material? I mean, it's the right time of the year to release a film, of course.
That's an interesting question. I mean, it was always said that Goodfellas didn't do well at the Oscars because it was featured such reprehensible characters. I think it lost out to Dances with Wolves, and Scorsese lost out as Best Director to Kevin Costner that year. There has been a tradition of Oscar voters going for more heartwarming, reassuring films. So in that sense, I can't imagine it's going to, win Best Picture or Best Director. Not only because there are stronger contenders in the form of, Gravity's been more popular and better liked, and 12 Years a Slave would probably be the conscientious vote to go for. And DiCaprio, I'd be sad if he didn't get an Oscar for this, actually, because, it's not that I care about Oscars, it's just that, he's never going to be better than this. He's never going to have a better role. It's as I said before, you couldn't imagine anyone doing this part better or being better cast. And he really gives it his all. It's a difficult role and a problematic film. But most of the film's successes are down to him.
Thanks very much, Ryan.
Thank you.
I'm joined by our science and tech writer Ian Steadman to talk about the death penalty. That sounds like initially like quite an odd thing to be talking about with the science and tech writer Ian, but the story essentially is there was an execution before Christmas in Oklahoma of a guy, and they had to use an out-of-date drug because the Dutch company which makes one of the three drugs that they use in executions has banned it from being exported to the US and banned it from being sold to the US prison service.
Yeah.
So what exactly happened?
The basic story here is that the US is executing people as the death penalty. There are 10 states that have it. But they're finding it really difficult to find the drugs because most of those drugs are manufactured in the EU, and the EU is quite strict about torture and the death penalty. This man in particular is a guy called Michael Lee Wilson, who by all accounts, not a very nice guy, who I think executed a convenience store owner during a robbery. Mm. But when he was being killed, he was, the idea is that you're given these lethal injection drugs
and you slip away. An anaesthetic and a paralytic, and then your heart
There are three drugs that are normally used. There's sodium thiopental or pentobarbital, which are both barbiturates, about the same. They basically send you asleep. There's potassium bromide, which paralyzes all of your muscles, and there's potassium chloride, which stops your heart. And usually it's that kind of cocktail mixed in that order, which theoretically, since the early 90s, has been used in these states to kill people. The idea being it's meant to be peaceful and not obviously distressing because
the victim's family are often invited to attend to watch the execution, aren't they? Is another reason. But again, I watched Michael Portillo, of all people, made a fascinating documentary about this. Another one of the problems is that doctors won't administer the drugs. They're administered by untrained people with a needle.
There are these bizarre setups where you have, like, there are three doctors we brought in and there's three buttons and all three press, but they don't know which one is the one that did it, so there's no culpability. In the same way they used to give fake bullets to people in the firing squads so that soldiers wouldn't have the responsibility of knowing who killed it. There's also the problem that the Eighth Amendment to the US Constitution forbids cruel and unusual punishment. So any execution that's seen as like psychologically scarring to someone who was subjected to it but then survived, for instance, would be seen as cruel and unusual, though there's a lot of leeway. It's really, really vague and quite obviously contradictory because you're killing someone. But the key point is there's the first one of those three drugs, pentobarbital or sodium thiopental. Those aren't manufactured in the US anymore. In 2011, the last company that made them went out of business or stopped making it. I can't remember which ones. And the main source you get it from was a company in Denmark. They quickly were horrified that their drug, which is normally just used as an anesthetic by doctors and vets around the world, they were horrified by it. So they started getting everyone they were selling it to sign all these waivers that said you were not going to sell it to a prison to use it for the death penalty. But then the EU, at the end of 2011, actually brought in quite strict export restrictions across all of the member states saying you can't sell these drugs to the US. And that kind of screwed over the prisons because these drugs have a sort of shelf life of about 2 years. And that 2 years is now up. And that's what people suspect has happened with this guy in Oklahoma, where they used drugs that were out of date. And he effectively, he didn't slip away. He kind of felt the whole thing where his heart stopped and he was paralyzed and everything. It's quite horrible. There's also a man called Dennis McGuire in Ohio who is due to be executed, and he's going to be subjected to a drug called hydromorphone, which is a different kind of anesthetic. And what you're seeing in the US now is this really weird situation where they're experimenting with different drugs to try and figure out a way of killing people humanely, which is just one of those really bizarre things.
It's a very odd situation. Julie Bindle wrote a piece for us last year about women who fall in love with men on death row. And one of the things that most strikingly came across about that is the whole kind of, actually the kind of culture of death row, and death row being a different type of prisoner. And the fact that these things go through appeals for 20 years and they go up to the governor's level and they go to state level and they chunter through. Meanwhile, people are being held in these absolutely tiny cells and left alone in the cell for 23 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those really difficult ones when it comes to kind of human rights, in the same way Guantanamo is a difficult one, because it's very hard to get sympathy for people who have done horrible things. But there is a fundamental human rights point about whatever you feel that people have done. What does it say about you as a society that you're willing to treat people like that?
I mean, these two men that we've talked about, they were convicted of their crimes in the late 80s. They've been waiting for that long for this to happen. They can now look forward to... hydromorphone is one of the drugs that's being talked about. There's also propofol, which is a bit like Valium. And there's this movement away from the three drug cocktail to just one drug, which is effectively kind of like giving someone a really high morphine dose. You give someone a dose of just any one drug, it'll be enough to kill them. But there's no way of knowing what it is like for someone to experience that. No empirical way of determining that other than reactions. And often these things, I mean, the aim is in under 7 minutes, they're meant to be dead. Often it can take 1 or 2 hours.
Well, I think another case before Christmas, they spent 2 hours finding a vein on somebody and then abandoned the attempt after a while. And I think one of the things that's quite interesting that I would love to know more about is about whether or not the families who go to watch this do feel a sense of closure that they have been promised all along, particularly through those incredibly protracted battles over the thing, about whether or not that does feel like, in some way, a weight has lifted, which is one of the reasons for having them there in the room.
Often not. Yeah. I mean, a lot of families, for a start, disagree with the death penalty or see it as not the form of justice that they'd like. And for those that do, the psychological impact of witnessing the execution it's not a moment that releases everything a lot of the time, which is a real struggle for them.
Yeah, it's really hard. I read a book by a forensic psychologist about murder victims, and one of the things that they say in that is he would recommend to families of people who'd been murdered not to go and leave flowers at the spot, because then you would have to do the same every year. And what's the year that you stop doing that?
Yeah.
Because there's no point at which you stop feeling that loss, that you feel that you've got over it, but people found it absolutely impossible to
to let go. And I think that's one of the things that probably we don't know enough about, because obviously, you know, how people react to having someone taken away from them, violently murdered, and what actually what they want versus what they need, if you see what I mean, or what they, you know, what they think they want. It's obviously very hard. But so where is this likely to go? Is America likely to have to stop executing people?
It's one of those things, again, it exists in a really weird legal space where there is that challenge from the cruel and unusual punishment angle, which means that states are trying very hard. I mean, we have no proof. A lot of these prisons are just outright, flatly refusing to tell anyone where they're getting their drugs from. And the only thing the FDA, the Food and Drug Association, can say is that, like, we haven't approved the import of any drugs that can be used in execution. So somewhere along the way, these prisons are finding drugs that they're going to experiment with to kill people. And whilst the death penalty has a lot of support in some of these states, so it's unlikely it's going to be overturned or repealed, it is likely you could see legal challenges to it purely on the basis of this is experimenting with humans.
And on that slightly grim note, no, thank you very much for talking to us, Ian.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil from the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and we are produced by Philip Maughan.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.